or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, unlike the promo we just heard for This American Life, which of course truly is one of the great programs of all time, if you know, storytelling is so important to being successful in your career. And the way they craft stories is unequaled. So I do encourage you, nobody's asking me to do this. I'm not required to do this at all. I just think that that's a great thing to do. But I will not scare you, but I will apologize to you. I was planning to moderate a debate today between a representative from the Rubio campaign and the Sanders campaign, but without boring you with the details, it fell apart. So maybe later, as they say. But I have prepared, hopefully, a lot of lemonade to replace the lemons. And so here we go. But most importantly, I'm going to give out the phone number right now. When I don't have a guest, you become my top priority. So if you or someone you love has got a career problem, and it really, really, really doesn't matter your age or your station in life, as they say, whatever your career problem, I've been doing this 26 years now, I usually can help you take at least a baby step, if not a giant step, and certainly the price is right, as I like to say, zero, zippo, nada. The phone number for what I call a workover here at KALW on Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And timely, I started last week to talk about the art of choosing a college, which is, of course, critical this time of the year. This is the time of year that especially the high school seniors, but certainly many adults and transfer students and the rest of them are thinking about where should I go to college or graduate school. And, you know, deadlines for the University of California tend to be November 30th, the Cal State University. So I covered it at some length last week, but the one thing I didn't cover, which I want to focus on today, is a pitch for at least starting at a community college. It surprises many people, but community colleges are not only inexpensive, they're often better for undergraduates than our most universities. And I just need to establish a little bona fides. My PhD is actually in evaluation of education. So this is, and I've written a number of books on higher ed. And while I am not averse to the understanding the value of a designer label and prestige, and we all know that Berkeley and Stanford will open some doors that a community college doesn't, at least starting at a community college is not only inexpensive, and then maybe you can transfer later to a Berkeley or, you know, a UCLA or whatever that you couldn't have even gotten into as a freshman, but they are often, as I just said, better for undergraduates because instruction is better, because hiring and promotion of faculty is based almost exclusively on how well someone teaches rather than how well someone does research. And I know the universities like to claim, oh, being a better researcher makes you a better teacher because you're in touch with the cutting edge. That's a fallacious line of thinking. Because if you have, first of all, the skill set required to be a great transformational instructor is, forgive the fancy word, orthogonal to, that is the opposite of, what is often required to be a great researcher. A great researcher focuses on the highly narrow, little cutting-edge micro area and is very esoteric, whereas the instructor is about communication, looking at the big picture, drawing inferences, motivating young people, and his or her time and energy is devoted toward enhancing students, being there not only at office hours but mentoring, whereas researchers are the opposite. The coin of the realm for them is journal articles. And so it's all about their research and perhaps some graduate students who are equally interested in their esoteric research. So that on average at community colleges where it's all about the teaching, you're going to get better instruction, better mentoring, etc. And even if you or your child is an A student, opportunities do exist for significant rigor. Sure, of course, there are honors programs at these community colleges which do offer top students small classes that are taught by top instructors, but also, in especially today where the cost of universities is absurd, well beyond what many people, except unless they were stars at Berkeley or Stanford, can expect to earn, many top students who are wise or come from wise families are attending community college. So in those basic transfer classes that you would take to maybe later transfer to a Berkeley, UCLA, you're getting some really top students. And so the teacher can pitch at least some of the instruction to those top students. And extracurriculars, those who do get involved. There's usually a full panoply of extracurricular activities on most community colleges, from clubs to intramural sports to radio stations to student government. The students who tend to get involved tend to be quite bright and certainly motivated. So for the $12 a unit that it costs to go to community college, you can get a superior experience and not mortgage your financial future or your family's financial future. There's plenty enough time to do that after you transfer. And the punchline is that many people today, because there is an oversupply of college graduates, it may, depending upon who you are, be wise to not aim to transfer, but to enroll in the many career preparatory programs that are more practical taught at the community college, from being a chef to a landscape architect to a robotics repair person. And finally, if you do want to transfer, it is often much easier to transfer to that designer label university than it is to get into it as a freshman. So I urge you to put aside America's obsession with status and worrying that your friends or your child's friends are going to have a decal on the back of their car that says Harvard or Stanford or whatever, and focus on the steak rather than the sizzle. Because once you start a life of chasing designer labels, you're generally forced actually to either mortgage yourself or take jobs that are lucrative but aren't what you really want. Because the same kind of person who's going to prioritize going to a Berkeley or a Stanford is likely later on to feel that it's worth spending the extra money on a Beamer or a Mercedes, even though it breaks down far more often than a Toyota, which has less, quote, prestige, but is much more reliable. Or to spend $200 on a Facanable shirt that is no better than a Costco shirt for $20 in any important way, or certainly not worth the 10 times the cost. You can buy 10 of those equally no-iron, high-quality, well-tailored cotton shirts at Costco or Walmart or Target. You can get 10 of those for the price of one Facanable at Nordstrom. So focus on the substance, not the image. So that said, one more thing I want to say about choosing a college. As you're developing your list, whether community colleges or not, thanks to, you know, technology really does offer an incredibly helpful set of tools for not only choosing a college. I'm writing an article right now on the best apps for improving your mental health, and there is something called Pacifica, for example, that is like, it's all rolled into one. It's almost like a cognitive behavioral therapist, a meditation coach, a self-guiding monitor, and all in one for $3.99 a month. So similarly for colleges, there is an amazing website, for example, that says it's called College Navigator, which is a searchable database based on factual information on thousands of colleges. But of course, what makes a college right or wrong for you is also subjective, a function of the quality of the experience offered. So it is important to review the students' reviews of their colleges. It used to be you would read the Fisk Guide to the Colleges or the Princeton Review Guide, which is still fine. But now you've got real-time, currently available, tons of student reviews of colleges on these websites, studentsreview.com, students with an S on the end, review.com, collegetimes.com, collegeconfidential.com, and niche.com. And then, after you've developed your own list, if you've got an advisor, like the free advisor you might get at a high school, college counselor or whatever, show the list and ask what that person thinks. But very often, with the power of these technology tools, it may be that you will come up with a wiser list using those technology tools. And as I said last week, just briefly recapping some of the more important factors in choosing college, Many college counselors say it's not smart to choose a college based on the major. I completely disagree. Because even though half of people change careers in college, half don't. And you can always change to something else. And given that there is an oversupply these days of liberal arts graduates, putting aside whether that's wise or not, but in terms of the job market, it can't hurt to go to choose a college that has a major you'd like. Secondly, selectivity is very important. Don't necessarily prioritize the colleges that are hardest to get into. Yeah, some students do better when they're among more capable classmates, but others do better and feel better as a big fish in a less selective pond. And if, in fact, you or your child or grandchild or whatever might be better off as a big fish in a less selective pond, that way the kid only has to apply to, you know, one or two colleges because those are the ones that are easier to get into. You don't need to go through the torture of applying to 12 colleges, not to mention the cost. And finally, location. This is an underrated factor. Location affects the kid, or again, the adult, every day. And I mean, you know, of course, you know, warm weather, weather climate is issue, or is it a climate that's similar or different from where you grow up in? That is New England versus here. And also, where you go to college or graduate school will have an effect on where you're likely to land a job, because your internships and fieldwork or whatever are going to be in that city. So think about where you want to live after you finish college or graduate school, and that should enter. So location matters. Okay, give out the phone number again. If you have a question about, certainly it can be about college or graduate school, but you know, which is only indirectly related to career, but certainly a prerequisite these days for many careers. Any question about college, graduate school, and importantly, career, whether you're 16 or 76, a clerk or a CEO, for-profit or nonprofit, on this radio show, Work with Marty Nemko, I do what are called workovers. So feel free to call in, and I will be happy to offer my help. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now I want to turn more explicitly to career. There is an almost fundamental belief in America that if only we work hard enough, we can accomplish only anything, especially if we pay the $99.95 for their, you know, handy-dandy little package and program. But the reality, at least from where I sit, having been now a career and personal coach to 4,900 people, and maybe I'm just an inferior one, but both in my own experiences talking with other counselors and among colleagues and friends, it really is hard to fundamentally change ourselves. I mean, how often have you heard of a dullard becoming brilliant? How often have you heard of a slacker becoming driven? How often have you heard of an obese person becoming svelte? A taciturn, shy person becoming charismatic? The procrastinator becoming highly productive? So, yes, it's true. Sometimes people do make transformational growth. One day the substance abuser decides no more, or the layabout decides to grow up, or the liar decides to be honest. But rarely is that something that gets worked on. It seems to occur almost magically. You know, it's like the substance abuser may have tried a program from AA to Zumba to no avail, and then one day simply decides that he or she is sick and tired of being sick and tired. So those are the exceptions, though. And so, in my judgment, it's usually wiser to accept your basic self and just tweak. So here are some examples of career tweaks that don't require a personality transplant. If you're, for example, a boss, start to develop a little more nuance, a little better feel for when to be permissive rather than to set limits. People tend to be one size fits all. They either tend to be authoritarian and set lots of rules for all their employees, or they're very permissive and laissez-faire. The better boss is much more nuanced, depending upon the situation, depending upon the person, decides how permissive, how rule-setting should he or she be. That's an art, but that can be learned. That's not a genetically heavily determined trait. So that's the kind of tweak that can make a big difference in your life without requiring a personality transplant. Or simply, if you're not a boy, anybody. You know, very often many people come to me for career counseling and are unhappy. And they say they come thinking that they need a radical career change. But when I look back on my successful clients who end up being much happier after we finished our work in 6 months or a year down the road, very often all they really needed to do was change bosses or workplaces or their attitude to, you know, toward work, but not a career change. Another a way in which we can tweak, which is simply improve a skill, like a software program. Make sure that you're the go-to person around some software program that's critical either in your current job or in your field. Maybe you have an accent that makes you difficult to be understood by most people. Work on your accent, either with a program like Rosetta Stone or with a person who simply you sit down with a digital recorder, you know, some MP3 recorder, and every time you mispronounce something, your tutor pronounces it correctly, and then for practice, you simply practice it. Your accent can be much more understandable, which can very much help your career. Simply, your posture. It's unfortunate, but we judge people based on whether their shoulders are back, or rather versus rounded and leaning forward, whether their posture is erect, whether you use what I call an Obama chin. Whenever President Obama says something, especially something controversial, he raises his chin slightly, which enhances his credibility. Crap like that can enhance your career. Those are tweaks. They're not career changes. An important thing, becoming a more careful, caring, and tactful listener. Everybody thinks they're a great listener, and most people are terrible. They're either jumping ahead to what they're going to say, or they're just in their own world, or they don't listen to what's really beneath what's said or what's not said. But that's also not genetically determined. So that's a great career tweak you can make. Become a more careful, caring, and tactful listener. Becoming neater and more organized. You know, some people are, by nature, are neater than others, more organized, but all of us can become neater and more organized, and that doesn't require a personality transplant. It's a great way to improve your career. Simply being a better dresser. Again, I hate the superfice, the artifice, the superficial nature of humankind, but especially in the workplace, we tend to judge people who dress moderately, you know, well-dressed, but moderately, not trying to, you know, show off too much by how fashionista forward they are. But that crap matters. Being smarter about budgeting and money. Many people are not money oriented and budgeting oriented, but in this day and age, whether nonprofit or for-profit or government agency feels they need to tighten the belt, decide that you're going to be smarter about budgeting and forecasting. Finally, whatever you're going to tweak, rather than take a course, it is often wise to use some combination of self-study, a tutor, and watching a master on live or on video. So, is there one tweak that you would like to make to your work life? If so, what would the first baby step be toward making that tweak? All right. If you want some help with your career, I'll be happy to tweak your career, help you tweak your career, or certainly some people make radical career changes. I'm open to helping you do that as well. Whatever your career problem, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, for what I call a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Are you talking to me?
I am.
Oh, good. Okay, Marty, I wanted to tell your listeners and you that there is a website which will give you evaluations of colleges in the whole country, but let's just focus on California. It happens to like what you said. For instance, Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo gets an A, and they also show the in-state tuition and out-state tuition costs, and they show the graduation rate in 4 years and that sort of thing. But the website is www.whatwilltheylearn, and that will bring up the, you can search by California or Georgia or whatever you want. Now, they evaluate it. Their grades are based on, do they expose the four-year grad, undergraduate, to seven basic courses that you probably all agree are valid criteria, and they are science, math, economics, government, history, language, literature, and composition. And Cal flunks, University of California, Berkeley. Stanford gets a C. And I'll give you an example. I went to Stanford and had my reunion yesterday. Stanford says that they count history as a one of their requirements, but they this grading system disallows their course, which they allow is the history of Hawaiian music.
You know, I'm going to interrupt you. I have a feeling this is probably just guessing. That this is a site that is not, that has got a kind of an ideological, perhaps conservative bias. I'm not against that necessarily, but I think we need to label it as such.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, I've never seen it to be so, except that the fact that it doesn't have an ideological bias might be considered conservative.
Right.
It's called the ACTA, and it stands for the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. And the reason trustees and alumni get in there is that is their focus. They contact the trustees and alumni, and they say, see here, your prospectus says you'll teach students this and that and graduate a wonderful person. And did you know, you're in charge of the thing, did you know that here's what they actually require?
I'm going to, you know, just for purposes of conversation, I do believe that an important purpose of an undergraduate education is that well-roundedness. But I'm not convinced that the true purpose of teaching history could not equally well be served, for example, through a course, and I'm sure that's not the only course at Stanford that teaches history, on the course a course on Hawaiian history. Let's say there was a professor there at Stanford who was an expert at Hawaiian history and could indeed teach the core universals that is the purpose of teaching history. That is, to understand the decision-making process that leaders made in a determination to declare war, to expand, to build out, to build, let's say, Honolulu into a business center versus a tourist area. All of that can teach many of the universals, and ideally, and again, unfortunately, in reality, at Stanford especially and Berkeley and research universities, they are less focused on those universals and more on the esoterica. But in theory, the fact that they're offering a course on Hawaiian history does not preclude at all its ability to teach those universals we hope for in undergraduate education.
I agree with you, but this is Hawaiian music history.
Whoa, I guess I missed that word.
Yeah, yeah. You did. Yeah, it was Hawaiian music.
Yeah, but again, would that be cherry-picked? I would bet my life that at Stanford there are many courses that would meet the history requirement, of which that's perhaps the most, you know, cherry-picked egregious example. Is that a reasonable inference?
Possibly. You'll have to look into it. But one of the, when you speak of what they allow, Cal, for instance, would argue with this rating. They'll say, well, the reason we don't require history is you pass your SATs to get in, you know.
Oh, well, okay. I'm going to push back on that, too, a little bit. Remember that it's not the SATs, but there is the SAT does not test history, but there are advanced placement history courses, history exams that you can indeed take to demonstrate that you have acquired a college, the equivalent of college-level competence in that. I'm also going to even make a counter-argument, because I'm not sure I believe it, but I might. It is well known that especially undergraduates, many of them are not intrinsically motivated, and you can make them take that course in history, but they will blow it off. They will download term papers. They will study only what they need to do to get the A on the test, and nothing. They will not be transformed. To allow students the freedom to choose a course that they're more motivated. Let's say we all know that as in college, students are more motivated by sex than most other things. And let's say we had no requirements, but that they were forced to take a college-level rigor course in the study of sexuality. They might be far more motivated to learn the material and yet accomplish the same things we're trying to accomplish in undergraduate education, that is critical thinking skills, the ability to analyze research, the ability to make a persuasive argument verbally and in writing. So I'm not convinced that those that rating a college A through F on the extent to which they teach the traditional courses is necessarily most likely to predict the value that students will derive in terms of writing, critical thinking, etc. That said, clearly the universities do a terrible job of that. I just read the latest collegiate learning assessment that found that 40% of all college graduates, and 41% don't graduate even if given 6 years, 40% of those who graduate score below proficient in writing and critical thinking skills. So don't take what I'm saying as a pat on the back of universities. They're horrible, but I'm not convinced that a rating system for colleges that rates them on how well they teach the traditional subjects is a valid criterion.
Okay, one thing you did leave out, I think, okay, is ability to find a spouse. You often end up marrying somebody you met in college, and that's another criterion.
Well, that's going to accrue across almost all colleges, and
right,
of course, the more selective the college.
Geography.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that that should be a defining character. You can meet a spouse anywhere. The key,
sure,
if you're going to meet a spouse, and these days people are marrying much, much later, but meeting romantic partners of any sort, going to a college where there are students who are not necessarily the best and brightest, but compatible with yours. For example, if you're a B or C student in high school and you think your thinking skills are a B or C student, if you were somehow, let's say you were an athlete and you were able to get into Stanford, and you're going to meet all these very brilliant women or men, whatever, romantic partners, you're less likely to find a compatible person, because a romantic relationship, while some of it is sexual, much of it is also how well you get along and are compatible out of bed. And if you are choosing somebody who's way either too high or too low cognitively, you're not going to get along that well. So, indeed, choosing a college should be about choosing a college where your intellectual and values peers are there in terms of politics, in terms of intellectual, and that's going to help you both in terms of enjoying college and meeting romantic partners. But we don't need to explicitly look at where am I going to meet a romantic partner in a particular college, because that will come out in the wash. Does that make sense?
Yes, except that the studies also show that, at least at Stanford, and it's probably true of almost all of the major universities, that if you get through the first year of a good college, you have 129 IQ minimum.
That's not worth debating. Anyway, thank you very much for the call. We have other calls online. Let me give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem or is in the throes of choosing a college or graduate school, this is that time of year where that choosing process is occurring. Or if you're at school, maybe you started out at college or graduate school. You've now been in about a month, and you're struggling. I would love to tackle your question or problem about how to negotiate, how to become more successful at college or graduate school, something I do know something about. So, in fact, I'm even going to talk about that a little bit in a minute. But the phone number for any kind of career or education-related problem, the phone number here at Work with Marty Emko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Actually, before I go to the phones, that seems like an appropriate thing to talk about, so I'm going to talk about that a little bit. First of all, I want to start, surprisingly, by focusing on the and calls on the line. Please stay with me. It's only going to be a minute or two. I'll go to your calls in just a minute. But this was just right on topic, so I figured I want to talk about it. It may seem odd for me to be talking about extracurriculars first, but really, academics are hard, especially if you're a struggler. If all you know, the natural tendency is, if you're struggling with academics, to spend all the time studying and working on that. That can be both. Not only is it not fun, and fun should matter and pleasure should matter in life, it increases the chance that you're going to burn out. Your frustration will continue to increase and you're more likely to drop out. So paradoxically, something I'd like to invite you to do, especially if you're struggling in college or graduate school, is to get involved in at least one extracurricular activity right away. In part, this also simply, most students do better when they have a, quote, home beyond their residence hall, like a club or an activist organization or the student newspaper or campus radio station, student government, whatever. Every college, every graduate, and even if you're a graduate student, all the co-curricular programs are available to you. You know, this is I think back, it's been a long time, but when I started my PhD program at Berkeley, I was very scared. I had only gone to Queens College, not a prestigious school, as an undergraduate, because I was a child of new immigrants and, you know, I went to the local college. So I was very scared when I got in the PhD program at Berkeley, and one of the ways I reduced my anxiety, I joined the college, the UC Berkeley Bowling Club. It was just something that I had done as a child, and it was no stress and non-intellectual. I got to meet some people, I bowled pretty well, and it was a great stress buster. So whatever it is, you know, especially if you're struggling at college or graduate school, get involved in extracurriculars. You don't need to study more than a few hours a day. More than that is probably going to reach some diminishing returns, especially if you're struggling. But certainly, get a tutor. If you're falling behind, don't, you know, there's a natural tendency to procrastinate. You figure you'll catch up later. In general, most courses build on each other, and the further behind you fall, the harder it's going to be to catch up. So right away, go see the professor. Ask questions in class. See the TA. Go to the tutoring center. Hire a private tutor. Because there's nothing that feels more dispiriting than falling behind and clueless as to what the hell that professor is saying. And then the midterm is coming up and you say, oh my God, now what? Also, when it's time next semester to choose your courses, there's a tremendous, just like the call, the previous call, I said, there's an enormous range of how difficult a professor is. Three units is not three units. You can get 3 units for breathing in some courses, and others, you're going to have to stay up all night reading book after book after book. Especially if you're a struggler, there's no need to climb Mount Everest. Find the hill level courses that will teach you those important things that are important to remember, which are the critical thinking and the writing and communication and appreciation of the important issues in life, but not necessarily the one with the massive reading list. And some professors are very communicative, and it's really easy and exciting to listen to them and for them to participate in the discussions they lead. Others, their accents are so heavy they don't even speak decent English, and they're so abstract that you don't begin to understand them. Please carefully choose your courses and professors. There are websites like ratemyprofessors.com that offers tons of student reviews, and then over-enroll. If you're planning on taking, say, 15 units, enroll in 18 and take the first class of each of them and then drop the one you like least. I'll stop there. Phone number here, work with Marty Nemko if you want some help with your career or education, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And to the phones, welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi, it's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was calling because I wanted some career advice.
Great.
So I'm educated as a school teacher, and the last position I was at just didn't work out. I also have a background. I have a film degree, and I'm interested in creative writing and screenwriting and cooking.
Okay. So tell me, first of all, when you said it didn't work out, what was the truth about why it didn't work out?
Well, I was asked to resign. I was just having for the classroom. My classroom management skills weren't going well.
Okay.
And I was having a lot of conflict with the kids.
Right. First, let me say this, dear caller and dear listeners, 30 to 50% of all teachers leave within the first few years, and classroom management is one of the biggest reasons. 80% of those idealistic Ivy Leaguers who join Teach for America don't go on to take teaching positions. It, notwithstanding what we see in the movies about the Mr. Opus, Mr. whatever, Holland's Opus, and Stand and Deliver, and how easy it is and transformational, it is really, really hard to teach in many of today's schools, in part because we have abandoned ability group classes, so you've got all kinds of kids from semi-retarded, I know we're not allowed to use that word anymore, sorry, developmentally disabled, to gifted, native speakers of English to newcomers to English, behavior disordered, everybody in the same class, many of whom come from very troubled backgrounds. It is an impossible, and we're asked to teach the Common Core, which is this highly rigorous curriculum that is completely elitist and irrelevant to the lives of 90% of, or many of those kids. Do not blame yourself. Is any of what I've said resonate with you as to what went on in your classroom?
Absolutely. I mean, I had kids who were emotionally disturbed, who were autistic, and I didn't have any support. And there were 30 kids and one of me, and it was just like I mean, I think there's a systemic failure happening in public education today. And I'm a very intelligent person. I'm highly educated. I have 2 master's degrees, and I couldn't, you know, learning was not the issue with us. It was just managing the kids.
My dear caller, I have heard this story again and again and again and again. Some problems, like stage 4 cancer, are bigger than we can tackle. And the reason I'm stopping before we move on to your career advice, which I do want, so many people feel like failures when they've had to leave the classroom. And I've taken the first few minutes of our call to reassure you that just because you couldn't handle that Herculean challenge doesn't mean that there isn't a place for you in the world where you're going to succeed and maybe even succeed wildly.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I did feel like a failure. And
exactly. I understand.
I do feel like, gosh, I'm so talented and I'm smart and I'm...
Right. It's not enough for that job.
And it's like, I don't know where to put myself.
Well, that's what we're going to turn to now. And that I have heard millions of very smart people, including those with PhD, you have 2 masters, PhDs, who are smart and kind and passionate and idealistic and all the rest of it, but some problems are simply too big. So, and there's a gift issue. You know, some people just have the magical gift of being able to not only control all that diverse group of kids, but to manage to individualize it. There is always a small percentage of people who have the gift, absolutely. But most mortals, even very smart, driven mortals, don't. So let's move on now. So, I want to learn more about, you mentioned the 3 things that you have a special interest in: film, creative writing, and screenwriting. It would be a mistake to try to explicitly go into those fields because there are lottery odds against succeeding in those fields, and I'm not a big fan of taking lottery odds, especially when you're not 18 anymore. And so I want to dig beneath the surface of those interests to see if we can find something more under the radar that would be...
Well, you left out... So my other interest in something that I've excelled in is cooking. I'm a vegetarian chef, and I offer cooking classes out of my house, and I do... I cook dosa, which is something that people are crazy for in the Bay Area.
Oh, let me let our listeners know. Dosa, are they like these... They're rice... tortillas, essentially filled with Indian food.
Exactly, yeah. And they're vegan and gluten-free. And I do, I cook for silence meditation retreats as a volunteer through my spiritual organization. And I do, vegan, gluten-free. I'll detox food, food that's very uplifting. And it's, and I'm also I'm a meditator, and I'm very interested in bringing mindfulness to the world. And even the group of kids that I left, I'm still working on getting them some mindful programming for them because they really need it.
Right. Okay. So now I'm going to, they often say that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. So I'm not going to stay stuck in what I had just said a moment ago about not utilizing your film or whatever. But when I'm listening to the fuller picture of who you are, I want to propose something very specific to you, not because I'm sure it's right, but I'd like to hear you tell me whether this is too crazy risky for you or not. What if we combined it all? What if you were to create a 2-minute video of teaching people how to make dosa, in which in the course of your, and no scripting, I don't want you to script it because it's going to seem stilted, in which you talk about mindfully cooking dosa and it being vegan and non-toxic. You bring up everything as you're making it. You're not just talking about the ingredients. You're bringing the essence of who you are into that 2-minute video as you're making a wonderful, tofu dosa. And then sending that 1 or 2 minute video everywhere, whether it be, first, of course, you're posting it on YouTube, and you see, if you don't know how to do it, you can hire somebody briefly to help see if they can drive some traffic to it or whatever. But then send that to everything from PBS TV shows, to produce executive producers of shows, to advertisers for meditation centers, Green Gulch or whatever it's called, and see if that little effort spawns a potential career that you may not have even have thought, whether it's on air or not, behind the scenes or not. But making a small effort, I'm not asking you to give up years of your life because that's too big a risk, but if you were to take a month to obsessively work to creating that little 1 or 2 minute video and then putting it out to the world and seeing if that generates interest, does that turn you on or turn you off, or is that just too
scary? Absolutely. I mean, that's something I've been wanting to do. I have an MFA in film production, and I, you know, 5 years ago was after film school, was trying to be a screenwriter in Hollywood in LA, and just was a starving artist and didn't make it. And I have a food related feature film. I have a feature script that's about my love for food, and it's a romantic comedy about a girl who grows up by, you know, getting a job in a restaurant, and the restaurant, she has a dysfunctional Indian family. I'm Indian, and she kind of finds a new family in her restaurant, and is able to find herself. And, you know, like, I have a whole script that I've been wanting to fundraise for and couldn't do that. So then I turned to teaching, which was my career prior to film school, and I have a teaching credential, and to make money and to make ends meet. And I'm just now, and so the plan was, you know, be a settled teacher, be a school teacher, and be able to make independent films over the summers, and, like, you know, have my bread and butter pay, like, all the things I want to do, none of them pay the bill.
Right.
So I'm just trying to figure out, what do I do to pay the bill so I can do what I want to do?
Right. So let's.
And so, absolutely, like, my latest idea has been, why don't I just make a cooking show about Ayurveda, which is the ancient Indian healing science that I'm passionate about, and a detox cooking show, and I have people come on air and, you know, they can give me their problem. Like, I have a friend who was crying because she just couldn't cook dinner for herself. She's too tired. So I, like, set her up. I said, here, take a rice cooker, take some brown rice and some lentils, and just push a button, and within 30 minutes, your dinner will be ready. And I gave her all the good fats and the spices and everything. I totally set her up. And I was like, that could be a show.
Okay, here is where I'm going to, you know, I like to have my head in the clouds, but my feet on the ground. I think you'd be setting yourself up for failure if you went that route. It's the same, you know, starry-eyed mindset that made you want to focus on feature films, made creating a feature film and creating a show. Again, we're dealing with lottery odds. And so I would much rather have you dovetail on what is Gen X and Gen Y and Gen Z, not Gen X so much, but Gen Y and Gen Z's, you know, millennials and Gen Z's, proclivity for very short form video. The era of the 30 minute show on PBS is dying, and the odds of getting one of those is you have a better chance of being bitten by a rattlesnake in your bed. So far smarter to dovetail with today's zeitgeist, which is to create a 2 minute video, not to mention that it would take a lot less time. And it costs you nothing, very little, to go and to see if that resonates with the world, whether it goes viral or you simply start meeting people in that space of creating 2 or 3 minute visually oriented things related to healthy eating. And that might be a lower risk way to immerse yourself in the world of tomorrow and today, rather than yesterday's world of feature films and 30-minute TV shows. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. That's my best advice for you for today. If you end up coming up with that 1 or 2 minute video, you are to email it to me. And if I like it, I'll do what I can to promote it.
Thank you. Well, what about paying the bills?
Okay, great. Great. I'm really glad you brought that up again. So, there are many ways to pay the bill.
What's a good career for me, given my skills and talent?
Right. But two things. First of all, for 1 month, which is all I want you to devote, I want you to devote yourself heart and soul to this video for 1 month. That's not going to make you homeless. But let's say after that or during that, I'm not going to send you to be an Uber driver, because that's totally dead end. I'm not going to tell you to be a waitress, because that's dead end. I'd rather you build on your existing skills. So either, because you're a teacher, tutoring can middle class parents, who can, those are the ones who can afford to pay, middle or upper middle class or rich parents, they are frustrated at hell, as hell, for the reasons you pointed out earlier and we pointed out earlier, with the public school's inability to meet the needs of kids who are, you know, either struggling or doing really well. Being a tutor at what you do well, you're a writing person. Being a reading and writing tutor for parents who can afford to pay is a way to make very often $50 to $100 an hour if you are self-employed to be tutoring. Or if for $20 or $25 an hour, you can be working for the many after-school tutoring centers that have popped up in order to serve the needs of those parents who are desperate to get better education for their kids. And so that's the most logical next step. Or there are, you know, millions of schools and training programs for wannabe filmmakers and artists and all the rest of it, possibly, and I think this is less likely, to get a job working as a tutor or teacher for one of those programs while you're working on this. And that also would be synergistic. It gets you into that world of people who are making a living doing that kind of stuff. What's your reaction?
Great. Yeah, I've already been applying for tutoring jobs. I'm just, I don't know if I could actually, you know, make like $60,000 a year.
No, that's not real. You know, unless you're a really great marketer. But for, you know, if you need, let's create a plan B. So we have, your plan A is the month creating this amazing video. Your survival income is going to be this tutoring. But let's talk about a radical career change now. Okay?
Right.
Great.
Great.
So, is it fair to say that you are primarily a word person rather than a people person, or is that wrong?
A word person than a people person. What does that mean?
Well, that you should spend more of your work time either writing or speaking rather than relationship building or selling or whatever. Are you more of a or managing people? Are you more word centric or people centric in terms of what you should be doing in your career?
I think probably word-centric. I tend to be able to get people to like me and be very persuasive on a short-term basis, but then I get into conflict with people on a long-term basis.
Right. And clearly your values are very Bay Area non-profit-y, vegan, you know, meditation. You know, you're a KLW listener, so, you know, that's all right. So is it correct to say that it should probably be in the non-profit sector?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, let's pretend you say you're a very serious meditator. If I were, for example, the head of a nonprofit that was mindfulness-based or organic healthy food-based, either one, let's take organic healthy food, and I am the executive director of this nonprofit that focused on healthy food, and I say to you, I'll give you any one of these jobs as long as it brings out the best in you and as long as it's going to be good for organization. You could be in human resources, which is involved in hiring people. You could be or benefits or conflict resolution. You could be in accounting and you'd have to go and take an accounting program and do more numbers. You could be more involved in coordinating the training programs. You could go be a grant writer and write grants so that our organic healthy food nonprofit gets grants from the government or foundation. You can become a fundraiser, either pitching people for donations or creating events that will be fundraising events. Which one of those, if any, do you want to do for me?
I would do fundraising, conflict resolution, and training.
Okay, great. The money is in fundraising. So when you're talking about, and it's not inappropriate at all, that you want to make $60,000 a year in benefits, in every field, whether it's for-profit or non-profit, money is the lifeblood of an organization. So if I said that what you need to do now as your plan B is to take some courses, whether it be online or in person, and they don't have to take years, it can take, some of these classes are like 1 hour or one half day or one weekend boot camp intensive on the art of fundraising so that you can go with legitimacy to the kind of nonprofits you believe in to say, I have now completed this, say, certificate program or these courses in fundraising, and I'm a true believer and very committed to, you know, organic, healthy, non-toxic, local, sustainable, organic food. And I would like to combine my passion for that with my new training in fundraising. and I am able to be persuasive by nature in short-term environments especially, I would like to work as an start out working for you as an assistant in the fundraising department, but eventually hopefully grow to do more. To what extent does that feel right and wrong for you?
Yeah, that's ringing some bells. I already raised $10,000 for my after school.
Awesome.
I did like an after school film program at the last high school I worked at, which I was pushed out of because of politics. They didn't appreciate me for what I'd done, and I raised $500 for the last job for a mindfulness program.
Awesome. So
I'm already I'm good at writing grants. I'm good at getting
great
money. I'm good at convincing people.
Okay. So I want you to get a little more skill. You raise some money. That's great. And those are the things you would certainly mention to a prospective employer. But I want you to, because your interests are so consistent with a majority of people in the Bay Area, I'm afraid that going after these jobs is going to be very difficult. So to make you more viable, in addition to those real-world wins, which I'm thrilled that you've had, I want you to gain some more chops, some more expertise, and that's why I'm inviting you to take courses, short courses, intensive boot camps, things like that, so that you can come to them with a more compelling package. And then identifying 5 or 10 nonprofits that are consistent with your values and pitching both your training as well as those successful real-world experiences. And I think that that offers you a great plan A, plan B, plan C. So to summarize, plan A is you're going to take 1 month. Don't worry about it if you can afford it, to just devote yourself heart and soul to creating the most amazing video you can that shows that it integrates you as somebody who is a great chef and teacher of chefing regarding healthy, organic, non-toxic food. Send that out to the world. In the meantime, for survival, do some tutoring and then take some short but intensive training programs on how to become an awesome fundraiser and grant writing, which of course is a particularly important part of fundraising, and then go to 5 or 10 of the nonprofits that are most consonant with your values and pitch that wonderful combination of skill sets now and interest. And that to me sounds like a coherent package that will help you move forward from the understandably difficult situation you had in teaching in our public schools today. How does that feel to you?
It sounds wonderful. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Please, one of the things I do love is when people call back. Not if you succeed, of course, that's great, but our listeners benefit enormously from hearing the full story, where it worked, where it didn't work, practically, psychologically. So I've given you a lot of time on the show today. The only thing I would ask is that, whether it be in a week or a month or 4 months, that you call back to tell your true story about what transpired as a result of our call. It would help
Absolutely.
Our listeners a lot. Okay?
Thank you so much.
I wish you the best. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
We have time probably for one more call if you are inclined. Many people are kind of last-minute procrastinators. If you have a work-related problem, I usually can help. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the things that is certainly true is that many people... All right, you know what? I think I'm going to do something quick because we got calls on the line. I think what I'm going to do is I'm not even going to do that. I'm just going to go go to the phones. Okay, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. How can I help?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm going back to school, and I'm taking a difficult class in physics,
right,
and I'm not doing well at all.
Okay. Would the God within you tell you should drop it, get a tutor, see the professor, or work harder?
I've seen the professor. I've seen the TA. I've talked to the students. It's a graduate course, and I don't think there's not. Times have changed since I went to school. People don't have time, and I'm thinking about trying to get some help.
Yes.
From a not so intelligent,
right,
not so accomplished,
right,
student, because he would have more. I would be able to help him. I mean, every time I come to somebody, I'm not enrolled. I'm a guest there. I'm not part of the curriculum.
I see.
I'm sitting in, But it's official. I mean, I have a number.
All right.
In
so you, I want to interrupt you. So you said you could help him. The reason I was so enthusiastic was that normally the best tutors are not those who are most expert, whether they have time or not, because they have a way of, they understand the material intuitively. They don't even understand. It's like me with playing the piano. I can't teach piano worth squat, but I'm born as a pianist. I can just do it. I can play anything by ear.
Yeah.
So what you don't want is the great physics genius. You want somebody who's struggling. So it could be either a fellow student in the class, or better usually is somebody who he or she has struggled to get an A or a B in the class, who will be able to explain things in the simpler way that is required. Does that make sense?
It does. I was going in that direction, but what happens after the class? Everybody disappears, and I don't have facial recognition with the lesser students.
What I would recommend you do is that you ask the professor to make it in the beginning of either show up early, 5 minutes before class as people come in.
I always do.
And then look for somebody who then, you know, I know your facial recognition is not good, but say in the next class, watch for people who seem like they're engaged and ask a good question, but are not like these geniuses, but they seem like they're not also super struggling either. And then during the break or afterwards, go to that person. Or ask the professor to make an announcement. Or ask if you can make an announcement. Say, I'm looking for a student who's not the super physics genius, but I'm looking for somebody who is doing pretty well, but is really working to get to do pretty well, to sit down with me, and I'd be happy to pay you $15 or $20 an hour to kind of tutor me. Does that sound like something you'd be willing to do?
That would be, I'm already facing, I don't know, that'd be too humiliating.
Okay, one more, because we're out of time, so I want one more suggestion. Very often, a high school teacher, this is a graduate course, I know that, but sometimes a high school physics teacher, because high school physics teachers are used to teaching a very wide range of students, they may be able to moonlight. Find a high school teacher, physics teacher at a high school near you, and phone him or her, or leave a voicemail or email or whatever, and ask if he or she would be willing, or what I would do is really, I would call the department chair of physics and explain my problem, and have that department chair recommend a particular teacher at that high school who's really good at explaining stuff, who might be possibly open to doing tutoring, and seeing if you can get that person that way. Does that make sense?
This is so far up the ladder from that, I don't see how that would work. The other thing I was thinking was getting on the online and trying to research it that way and try to get some, break open some of these equations and understand what the letters mean.
Certainly, self-study is a great first step. I normally recommend for somebody struggling to use a tutor combined with self-study. I must go. The show is over, but I wanted to give you as much time as I could. Anyway, and one more suggestion for him would have been to also contact the professor at a community college who may, you know, well have great credentials and be up the ladder as he or she said, as he said, but be good at communicating. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers and millennials and Gen Zers, Generation Zers, they're really quite different in how they approach life, including their career. I'll tell you what I know and I've been learning recently. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.